Hello and welcome to the new series of the Growth Masters podcast. I'm your host, Robert Tadros. Today, we're diving into a world where passion meets purpose in the realm of entrepreneurship. With spotlights, the game changers behind Who Was Elijah, Raquel and Adam Boris. This duo has reimagined the fragrance industry with the unique vision, creating unisex, cruelty-free scents that challenge the traditional giants. Join us as we uncover the essence of their journey, the challenges, and the scents that are setting a new standard in the world of fragrance. Let's jump straight into it. Well, Raquel, you mentioned you've just, you guys are moving offices. So where are you now? Where are you going?
Yeah, so we're in Tarran Point and we're staying in Tarran Point. We're moving literally around the corner. Okay. We have been in the ugly warehouse that I'm sitting in right now. We've been here for 3 years. It served its purpose. We just kept outgrowing it. We had to take over the warehouse right directly across from us as well when we started to grow. When was that? That was just over a year ago
yeah.
Now.
Yeah, nice.
And then someone was building this big, shiny, new white monster of a warehouse factory. Is that what you call it? Around the corner. And we started, Adam actually noticed it. And this was probably 4 months ago. When you first saw it?
Yeah, I saw it probably midway through last year, to be fair.
Yeah.
And I thought that
it was way too big and we couldn't afford it. Well, we didn't even know how much it was going to be, but we didn't think we could afford it. But then we ended up biting the bullet a few months later and now we're already saying like, gosh, I don't think it's big enough. So, yeah. But it's beautiful.
Very, very good. Well, let's go back, I reckon. Let's start at the beginning, right? Inception. And I'd love for kind of either of you to share the story behind the inceptions of Who Was Elijah, right? Like, what was it about that Californian road trip that really inspired you to start, you know, this fragrance house?
Well, it was 2017. I went to Coachella and Adam and I had actually just started dating and he coincidentally was going to Coachella as well. So I love
coincidence and, or
was yeah. It was a genuine coincidence.
Yeah, right.
We sort of saw each other like a year prior, didn't work out. We sort of like, you know, went our separate ways. We bumped back into each other and just sort of had a chat like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? You know, I'm going to Coachella. I'm like, oh, I'm going to Coachella. And it's like, oh, I'm going to Vegas first. I'm like, I'm going to Vegas first. I'm like, I'm staying at the Cosmo. I'm like, I'm staying at the Cosmo.
Oh, wow.
And we just had this like identical trip book. Yeah. Like it was pretty wild.
It's meant to be.
It's meant to be.
So it was on that trip. So 2017, that's 7 years ago coming up because we're just about to go to Coachella again. And I was at Coachella and my friend brought along a friend and she just smelled amazing. And it was this little tiny bottle of fragrance oil that she, like it was from India. And I don't know, I just loved it. And then I took a photo of it and when I got back home, I tracked it down online and I started wearing it around. Adam lived in Vaucluse. I lived in Cronulla, just wearing it around both areas. And it was nonstop people coming up to me, tapping me on the shoulder, asking what fragrance I was wearing. And then after, I think it was like six or so weeks, I just sort of said to my friend that introduced me to the friend, it was a bit of a rosé induced idea to start recreate this fragrance because people love it so much. And, yeah, here we are, 6 or 7 years later almost.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
When do you turn 7? Is in March or?
Well, we turned 6 in in October of this year, but that sort of like idea to launch took a little bit.
It took 12 months. Raquel was working
full-time. Had a baby. From Coachella to launch was a year and a half almost. Yeah. Cause we launched in 2018, October.
Right.
Yeah.
New mom, new business.
Yeah. And I had a really good job. I loved my job. So I wasn't like, I hate my job. I want to do something else. I actually really loved my job. So, but then COVID happened and then I launched before COVID and then COVID happened and that's when I decided to leave my job.
And what were you doing prior?
Okay. I was an executive assistant for CEOs, CFOs at a luxury hotel group. I loved it. I was there for nearly 4 years.
Oh, wow. That's a bit of a shift, right? From
I know, and then I became a CEO, and then I hated being a CEO, so then Adam became the CEO.
And Adam, what's your story, man? Like, where have you come from? What's your background? I know I've read online you've started a few companies.
I was a tradesman when I first started, cabinet maker, and did my apprenticeship, left cabinet making, didn't like it, and then went away, traveled for, 6 or 7 months, came back, realized that I was okay at cabinet making. I was pretty good at it. So my mom actually pushed me into starting a business just on the back of a lot of phone calls I was getting for people wanting like little jobs done here and there. And then within about, 12 months of me starting a kitchen design business, I had a team and we were doing big jobs in the city and really nice homes in Sydney. So I built that business. I think there was about 7 or 8 of us throughout that period. We had quite a good business. I sold it 8 years later. So I had a kitchen design business. During the 8 years, I started an online business selling bow ties and ties called Nice Ties Finished Last. We got that into a partnership with VaynerMedia, Gary V, and VaynerSports. Wow. We were the bow tie supplier for all of their NFL athletes for a season, which was really cool. I flew over there, met Gary, met the team, went to his office, which was pretty cool. Like I was just thinking about the other day, like it was quite a, impactful moment to go and do that when Gary was just on his big, come up as well. And on the back of that business, realized that influencer marketing and the transaction in between the influencer, the brand and the content was sort of missing. So we built an app that allowed you to sort of transact inside a piece of content as opposed to switch between websites and, get lost along the way. So built an app, it was called Snatch It. Got it to the point where we had about 10,000 users, 200 brands, Q Clothing, some big guys were coming on board. We just couldn't get funding to get it to the next level. We needed funding. Tried a funding round, failed. Didn't know what I was going to do. Had sold my kitchen business. Raquel had Who's Elijah. It was still small thing in our garage at the time, but we could see that it had legs and it was growing. So I was always in the business, obviously living together and helping out as much as I could, building the warehouse, the garage setups and the storage setups and just listening into all the conversations with the team. And obviously I had some previous experience with the other businesses along the way. And I think 2 years into Who's Elijah, I was getting itchy to get in and help and just jumped in and loved it ever since. So I had a few different businesses along the way, failed at some, succeeded at some, and now I've got that back, that 12 years, 13 years behind me now of struggle and pain through business. It sort of feels like normal for me, but I feel like I've found my spot.
That's what you need, right? It kind of springboards you, right? It's all that experience that you can really take from one role into the other.
Yeah, and I heard Jane Liu the other day actually say one of her, things on her content was to start a business that's not your forever business straight away, because you'll probably suck at it and you'll fail at it and it will be painful, but you'll learn a lot from it. And it sort of clicked to me that I'd done that 4 times along the way. And that's why I feel really comfortable in this role now.
Is there a reason why VCs highly back those that have failed once and twice before?
Yeah.
Right. That's right. Intentional, right? They go looking for entrepreneurs that have failed on numerous occasions because they know they've learned and they've taken that into the next experience.
Yeah, that's right. And we struggled to get funding because we now in the app because we didn't have reputation. I didn't have, significant business experience. I wasn't ex Shopify or ex Facebook or ex Google, or I was just a cabinet maker that had a cool app. So we just couldn't get in the rooms. But
in some rooms though.
We got in some rooms, Afterpay and ZipPay and all those guys, but we just couldn't convert it. So
I mean, man, that's an amazing experience, right? Like that in itself is something, it's a huge learning curve, right?
Yeah. It'd be different now. We can get into rooms now, but different now.
They come to us now.
Yeah.
That's right. Now, Raquel, correct me if I'm wrong, but you had a business partner initially, Matt, if I'm not
Matt,
mistaken.
Matt, yes. Yeah? My good little friend, Matt.
Yeah. What happened there? I'm trying to kind of piece that puzzle.
Yeah. Oh, it was like it wasn't even who was Elijah then. So this is sort of like the reason behind the name as well. So Matt was who I went to Coachella with, and he's the one that introduced me to his friend with the oil. Right. And we're best friends, still best friends. Mm. And we were just hanging out, drinking wine on the weekend. And that's when the idea sort of like came to fruition. I think it was my idea. I can't remember exactly. I think it was my idea.
Sure, don't worry.
But yeah, so we did start it together, and like obviously we're not perfumers and had no idea how to make perfume. So I was trying to find a perfumer. I found one, and
Matt had experience in
retail.
Retail. He was
right. Really, really good retail experience.
He was a buyer at the time for Under Armour.
Okay. Yep.
So he quite significant experience in big e-com businesses.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably ultimately why it didn't work out in the beginning, because he was coming from this like, this is how you need to do it, you know, scenario. And Raquel was like, well, I don't want to do it that way. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, ignorance from Raquel and knowing, but she wanted it intuitively to be done that way. And they sort of like clashed a bit on a few things and wanted to keep the friendship.
And it wasn't even like, we weren't even fighting. We just, I just said to him, like, you know, you in or you're out, like, cause I'm really like into it now. And then he just said like, oh, no, like, I don't want to do it anymore. Like, you do it. And I was like, okay. And then so, like, I went and got, like, a new ABN. And then I didn't, because we were originally going to call it Raquel and Elijah, just because Matt just loved the name Elijah. And then when that all happened and I was sitting at my desk, I just sort of said, who the fuck is Elijah? And then that was the name.
and here we are. It's a great name, by the way. Yeah. I love it. Yeah, it is. It's biblical, isn't it? Elijah.
Yeah, I'm now starting to. I'm not a very biblical person,
right.
But I do get a lot of questions about that. Like twice yesterday, actually, I had people asking, like, does it have like a biblical connotation to it or reason behind it? But no,
people think the new warehouse is maybe a church. Because it says like, who is Elijah, like on the front of it,
right? There's something in there, right?
Yeah.
We can tag that as far as the brand evolves. Yeah. So the ethos of who is Elijah blurs kind of traditional lines of, you know, gender and fragrance, right? If it's fair to say that, right? Like, how important is this gender neutral approach for you guys? And, you know, how has it sort of shaped the development of the products as well?
Well, I think there's like two sort of reasonings behind this. So the first one is I have always gravitated towards more of a masculine type fragrance, so I started making fragrances that I liked, so they had a little bit of a masculine, I think I'm maybe more masculine with a little bit of a feminine twist majority of our fragrances, and that is just based off what I like personally. But also when we started the business, Matt is gay, and I being his best friend, I am, you know, a big part of that community, and I love that community. So I just think like if we can ever do like everything should just be for everyone, and I'm just a massive believer of that. It's kind of just came naturally to us.
I think, like, you know, there's this like having a scent that's great for you and might not be great for anyone else, but we just like let it be open to anyone. And if you know, we have a product, a discovery set product that has all of our fragrances in it that we encourage everyone to buy. If you find one that you like, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are, who you represent. It's like, if you like the smell and it smells good on you and it makes you feel confident, then we're happy to do that for you. So, yeah, I think that we've always just maintained, like, let's just leave it open for anyone to wear it. And if they love it, then they love it.
Mm.
And from a, like, from a creative perspective then, because I'm assuming that kind of flows into this process, right? Can you maybe, Adam, can you walk me through that creative process? I mean, Raquel, I know you're the creative director. I'm going to point this one at the CEO here. You know, how do you go from an idea or a moment that's worth capturing to a finished fragrance?
Yeah. Well, you know, when it comes to like, all right, we're going to next quarter or next, you know, 6 months or 12 months, what do we want to bring to life and how do we want to do it? We will look at all sorts of inspiration from everywhere, from trips that we've been on or from, you know, just general market research about what's happening out in the world. Raquel will go and sit with our perfumer for months and months and months and months and months and come up with, you know, a sample set of five or six fragrances that we think we're going to head down in this path. And, you know, to be fair, we don't do like this big customer analysis and this big, you know, questionnaires, or we're not really at that level yet. We're still this early days, you know, startup that's figuring it out as we go. But Raquel will use her intuition for a lot of it, to be fair. And, you know, when we travel a lot, we're in Vegas, we're in Europe, we're in the States, we're everywhere all the time. And, you know, if we go in, you know, to a place and, you know, get some inspiration from some scents or some candles or whatever it is that brings us back to that moment, then we will, you know, try to recreate that back here in Australia with our perfumer. And it's a process that takes probably 12 months from start to finish, 6 to 12 months from start to finish. We will, again, get the inspiration from Raquel. She'll sit with the our perfumer. They'll go through samples for months. And the team's just all sitting here, just waiting for the moment when Raquel is like, yep, that's the one. And sometimes it's a false alarm. It's like, yep, this is it. And then we're like ready to go, packaging, branding, content. What is the story? Who is it? What is it about? And they'll change it again and they'll change it again. And we're all just sitting, waiting. And once, you know, she lands on a scent, then the creative team will come up with a story about it and, you know, try to create a brand image for the actual scent, run all our campaign messaging. And it really just goes into like full speed ahead for a launch. We'll do, you know, whether we're doing pre-order or limited edition, and all of these different variables come into play. It's a huge team effort this year where we're aiming to launch
16
fragrances. Last year we did three.
But there's a couple of different brands in there. So we've got a new brand starting, Perfume X. So that's sort of, it will sit under the Who Is Elijah umbrella. But that is actually, it's really like colorful pink, purple, orange, that Gen Z sort of target market attached to that. So that has four fragrances in it.
Yeah.
We are going to do a men's range. But I'm wearing them actually now. Can you smell it? It smells really good. Just because it's just still something that we do get asked about is like, what's the men's one? Yeah. And that's like, some people still need to be, I guess, talked to in that traditional, this is for him, this is for her. So, I mean, it's not obviously just for a man, but I think we're going to do it like quite like gentleman, like sexy bottle, a bit different.
Yeah, it allows us to, again, as you said, like create a whole different content theme around the brand as well. And, you know, we've always been, you know, this female focused content in all the content that we do, because, you know,
it's all females that work here.
The females that work here, but it's also that, you know, 75% of our customers are all females. So we know that and it's resonating with them at the moment. So we're just, you know, elevating that content all the time. And when we now want to go into, you know, men's fragrance, it's obviously look at the legacy brands and how they introduce a men's fragrance, whether it's Chris Hemsworth or Johnny Depp or one of these big, you know, faces, that the way that they introduce men's fragrance is very different to how they do women's. So it's exciting for us to bring that to market and see how the customers like it. But a lot of my mates that are tradies that are, you know, construction sites, they're all there, and they tell me every day, they're like, oh, I'm always taught, the crane driver came down to me, he's like, mate, what fragrance are you wearing? He's like, I'm wearing Muse by Who Is Elijah. And I find it so interesting that like two grown tough men will talk to each other about how they smell on a construction site.
And they're wearing Who Is Elijah.
And yeah, it's my mates messaging me all the time because they're last minute shoppers. They're like, where can I get Wall Street from? I'm like, the warehouse is shut, go to David Jones. And I have them running around town. Sometimes they're Miranda, sometimes they're at Bondi Junction, and they send me photos, I've got it, and you know, they wear it out and have a good night, and like, oh man, you know. So the way that men talk about fragrance is quite it's much more like, you know, bigger than I thought it was.
It's super interesting because I'm admittedly, right, like my wife Jess, she buys me my fragrance. Right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Nine out of 10, she's the one that actually wears it first before me. So,
yeah.
You know, to hear that, you know, there is this conversation that is being had on a construction site, for me anyway, that's super fascinating. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we've started that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's...
You've started a trend, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, when I was younger, we were getting ready to go out. Like, some of my mates had, like, their cupboards, like, stacked, like, five or six rows deep with fragrance. You know, everyone has a couple of those mates. They can probably go back to that moment and go, oh, what fragrance are you going to wear? You either have one. I just had, like, one or two. Or there's the mate that's got 30. So, yeah, I think that it's not, you know, branded or spoken about as much, but I think we're excited to bring the men's to life. Yeah.
It's an awareness piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talked a lot around the process. And for those, I guess for our listeners that don't understand what it actually takes to produce a perfume, right? Maybe Raquel, if you can talk us through, like, you know, what actually goes into creating the finished product. Because it sounds like, you know, for 12 months to produce a perfume, I mean, that's a long time, right?
Yeah, I guess like the longer, well, there's two parts, like the start of it can be quite long or it can be really short depending on the fragrance really. Like now I think we're starting to create a lot more complex fragrances, so the process is getting longer. So Brad is our perfumer. He is amazing, but he is a perfectionist. So I'll try and sign off on a fragrance and be like, no, we can make it better. And then he'll go back and, you know, he might spend anywhere from like 2 to 6 weeks on, you know, changing it up, adding ingredients, minimizing one ingredient. Like the slightest little changes can make such a scent difference. Change.
He has a factory that's, you know, it's huge what they do there, and he's like, his nose is responsible for like so much stuff, and it's wild to me that he's like, he's got this like job that's so important to smell and taste, that his senses are so heightened to that.
Yeah,
must just walk around with a bowl of coffee beans, right?
Yeah.
I'll give him something and like he'll just like smell it and he can like pick something apart and he'll be like, yep, there's cherry, there's vanilla, there's citrus. And I'm like, how? Like, I can't smell any, like I can smell like one of those. Like, how do you smell of that? And like, he's correct. Like, it's all in there. So he is a big part of that process. Like I never try to say that I'm the one making the fragrance because it's not, I had the inspiration, but Brad is the one actually creating the scent. So he is our, he's the start of it. So once we sort of, once he comes to me with usually like 3 samples towards the end, and then when he finally signs off on it, after I've signed off on it, then he has to write up like all of the, what is it, like the technical, like ingredients listing, the allergens listing. So then that's what we legally have to put on all of our packaging. So once we have that, that's when the sort of packaging process starts. And then I then show the team the fragrance, and then we try and come up with a name. But lately I've been coming up with the name almost before we even start the fragrance. No one gets a chance, no.
Normally we would put it to the team to, you know, this is a fragrance that's coming out. If you name it, and we choose the name, you'll get $500.
Right.
Again, we get to the point where it's like no one knows what's going on in the background. Raquel comes in.
I'm really good at the names.
This is what we're doing, and it's called this. And we're like, well, no one gets the chance to.
But everyone loves the names.
To have a try, but the names are like super important, and I think they really do represent the fragrance itself. Yeah. Nomad, you know, we've got one coming out. I don't know if I should talk about it, but
no. It's called initials ES.
Yeah, initials ES is really cool, but the color of it, the actual, you know, imagery and campaign that's going to be built based off the color of it and the smell of it is very different to anything that we've done. Mm-hmm. So Raquel and Brad really spend like a ton of time getting that right, and it allows Raquel to like really get a sense of what the fragrance is, how we're going to market it, what words and terminology and you know, content we're going to put together for it based on it. So it's really, really important. And then everything goes after that happens into this full project plan that we have step by step to build it to scale so we can distribute globally. You know, we've got our warehousing, manufacturing of the products, you know, distribution to all of our 3PLs, loading everything into everybody's systems, creating all of the content for the hype campaigns to build it up, knowing when the day is that we can start to sneak peek it, not going early, not going late. Like it's all really dialed into this pretty clean program, especially This year we're going to bring out 16 fragrances. Last year we did 3. So you can imagine the project plans are like day by day, very critical. Something moves around. It's like a ripple effect. So yeah, it's a lot of internal communication, a lot of Slack channels, a lot of Mondays boards. But yeah, once it comes to life, it's usually a bit of a sigh of relief, to be fair, once it goes on, you know, hits the market and goes live. But yeah, it's super exciting. It's a lot.
Because what I'm hearing is like each fragrance, it's got its own personality.
Yeah.
Its own brand, its own identity.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's ultimately like it's, you know, you're launching 16 new products this year.
Yeah, 16.
Each one has got
people, yeah.
And I think like storytelling for each fragrance is really important because, you know, we don't have our own stores, but we do have a lot of wholesale stores. But it's been really important since day one to be able to, you know, for the customer online thinking about it, to be able to close their, like read the description, close their eyes and be able to almost imagine what that smell, what the fragrance smells like. So we're getting a lot better at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, because I guess we're still predominantly an e-commerce brand, but we do have like 700 stores that we can send people to, which is good as well.
And sustainability and I guess the ethical practices kind of underpin the brand, right? Can you kind of elaborate a little bit more on how you measure, how do you measure that, right? To ensure that the products are environmentally friendly, ethically produced and so on and so on. Like, do you have a process or measurements in place along the way against the production line?
Yeah, so our fragrance itself is all very ethically made. Like we, Brad and his company, they have like we make our fragrances as per the IFRA standard. So they are like the EU, the European and UK like cosmetic standards. So they're very, very strict. So we are registered, our products are all registered to be able to sell in these regions. And to do that, you have to go through really rigorous like testing and sustainability, like checking. They check your ingredients. And if there's something in there that they don't allow, you have to remove it. So we don't, that gives us the confidence that we know that our fragrances are
they wouldn't pass the test. We wouldn't be able to sell into these countries if those IFRA standards were like rejecting our fragrances.
So that gives us confidence, and it's a very easy confidence to pass on to our customers as well once you explain that standard. And if you read the standard, it's like, oh wow, it's like very, very, very strict. And then in terms of like internally, the first thing I noticed when I first started Tools Elijah was I couldn't afford to do like really good packaging at the start, so I just had a brown box. But I did notice in the department stores that all cosmetics are wrapped and wrapped and wrapped in plastic. I think it's a little bit maybe different now, 6-ish years on. It's is it cornstarch that people are using? But even still, I just said no plastics at all. So we don't have like plastics in our packaging. We pretty much could almost run Who's Elijah with hardly any power. Now we're starting to get machines. We're starting to use a little bit more power. But there was a time when we were hand filling everything and doing everything by hand. I think the only power we used was for the printer. So that was for like 4 years.
And we also have a so our Chinese suppliers of our raw materials product, not fragrance, our bottles and packaging and things like that, we have a man on the ground in China that goes and visits all the factories to make sure that they're ethical. You know, ethically, you know, looking after their employees and their safe work environments and all of that. That's really important to us. And if I'm going to, you know, be heading over there this year as well to go and check and have a look at everything as well. We haven't been able to with COVID over the years and being so much growth, but I'm excited to go over there and chat with all the suppliers and meet with everyone. And yeah, we really, you know, we really make sure that, you know, everyone's being looked after. And Raquel and I personally are very, you know, we give a lot to charities and making sure that, you know, we're putting our money towards the right things.
I read about that actually. I Equals Change and the partnership. So it's super fascinating, right? Like how do you decide on that project to support, you know, and what impact do you have to achieve, I guess, through that initiative?
Well, I am like, I feel everything very deeply. I really care about the world, and I think the world is very dark, and everyone that needs to do something every day to make it, you know, 1% better, or like, honestly, we need to go 50% better every day. But IECA's chain, we noticed that a lot of reputable brands in Australia were using it, like our P Nation. Back when we started using it, they did like a big article about it. I think they'd given like $1 million to IECA's change or something. So that's when we started to look into it. And I think like when people think of charity, like I always ask like how much, what's the percentage that actually goes to the people in need and what's the charity keeping? So IECA's change is really, really good. Like they're actually helping with the money that we're getting. And it's so simple, like a dollar from every sale goes there. And then when there's big, they do events throughout the year. I think the last one we did was for maybe, I forget what it was, but you can donate extra. So increase it from $1 to $3 to every order. I actually don't know how much we've given lately, but I mean, it's in the tens and tens of thousands every month that we donate just from one day, $1 every sale, which when you think of it, it's, you know, almost nothing to give per sale. So it's an easy way to help.
And look, I mean, I read last year you were doing 6,000 units a day, right? So
that's
right. Yeah. That's over 2,000 units a year, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
2,000. Yeah. Oh, now
we're
about a day.
Yeah.
What have you reached now? 10 a day? 10,000 a day?
Look, not 10,000. At times, big events, big sale days, you know, 40,000 a day. Oh. Which is pretty crazy. Hmm. But yeah, consistently.
You can't hand pack those every day.
No.
Got the machines now. Machines
now, but we prep for it. But yeah, look, a lot of growth is we thought last year was our breakout year. I think that this year will really be our, and I'll say it again next year as well, but will be our big year this year with all products and new warehouse and everything. So we're moving through some stock, and you know, I've just ordered this machine from, you know, custom made from Italy, nearly $500,000 worth of machinery. So we're really committed to it, and we're going as hard as we can.
Mm-hmm. Guys, launching and establishing a brand like Who Is Elijah in such a competitive space, right? Like, that's not easy. I can't imagine that would be easy at all, right?
So no, can that's you just... when I started, I thought it was.
That's always naive. The case, right? You're always a little bit naive when you first kick off. Can you share like some significant obstacles that you, kind of, you know, that have faced you, and then how you've been able to overcome them? And I'm sure there's heaps, right? But if there's a particular one in a moment of time where you went, shit, man, that was like, that almost broke us, both mentally and emotionally and everything else in between.
I don't know. My answer to this question is always like, you know, I say it all the time, and like, it always gets in the headlines, but like, my dad told me I was an idiot for starting this business, because who's going to buy my perfume? Because there's already so many perfumes on the shelf, and they're all, you know, conglomerate. I never know how to say that word. Heritage brands that have really, really deep pockets. So I think that, but again, something different on the shelves, it sparked people's interest. I think that actually helped us at the beginning. I don't know. Now it would be a little bit different. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I think the challenge, like at the end of last year, at the end of 2022, we started in this place, November, where we were killing it. We were like doing as biggest sales we've ever done. It was all exciting. I moved us from an agency to another agency, made a huge mistake with that. The new agency came on board and just spent a ton of money that, you know, they shouldn't have. Internally, we didn't know how to manage or understand what was happening in our advertising spending. We additionally, at the same time, we partnered with a UK big brand to launch us into the UK that cost us well over $100,000 to set something up that just was a terrible partnership to be in.
Failed.
And that failed. The agency failed. We were probably facing like some really serious financial problems, bankruptcy maybe at the start of 2023. And we didn't know how we were going to get out of it, to be fair. I remember Raquel rang me in tears. She's like, everything's broken. What are we going to do? This agency's killing us. The UK brand's killing us. What are we going to do? And I went, we had no money, you know, on the surface level, the brand looked like it was exploding, but internally we made, you know, we stacked two or three bad decisions that cost the brand $50,000-$100,000 each. That's 250 to 300 grand in the whole of a small business that the start of the year sales are slow. So it was a really tough time. Mikhail rang me in tears and I said, all right, let's go fire the agencies. Let's get out of this contract with the UK, whatever it takes to get this contract ripped up. I'm going to go do it. We'll fire the agency over the phone in the car on the way back to the office. Before I got back to the office, Raquel rang me in happy tears. And I'm like, and the office is 10 minutes away. I'm like, what happened? She's like, come back. So I went back to our house and she's like, Priceline just rang and they want to place a $1.6 million order in 30 days.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, what the fuck?
That literally just gave me goosebumps.
So, you know, we were in this point of complete tears and it wasn't over to, like, they had never even emailed us. They had never, it was just they cold called Raquel's mobile, said, hey, we've been looking at the brand. You know, we want to stock you in 200 stores. Here's the order. And it was complete disbelief. Like, I had goosebumps and adrenaline for like 5 or 6 hours. I just couldn't quite wrap my head around that it had happened. And came back to the team, said, guys, like, lock in, like, we've got some stock to move, you know?
And we had no machines back then. It was 42,000 bottles that we had to fill in 30 days. And we did it, but all by hand.
Manual.
And then because when we got that first money from Priceline, we bought our first machine because it nearly killed us. Like, the team were working like 12-hour days, 6 days a week.
We, at the same time, let go of the agency. Mm. I decided to take on the Facebook ads and learn it. And learned through really great community e-commerce equation. And within a month, I took over the account. I was doing better than the agencies previously by myself on 4 weeks experience. then we ran an end of financial year sale on the back of like a week's notice with the team. We did 6,000 orders in 2 days. And then we had a huge order from Priceline. Mm-hmm. We knew how to run and manage an online advertising campaign. And we just built on the back of it. And we had this momentum in the end of last year because we were in so much of a dark place there, and it just came back to us and we just weren't going to let it go again. Mm-hmm. So we just went for it, you know.
Again, it's like this moment in time that you just learn from and it propels you forward, right?
Yeah.
Failure is not an option when you're in that position.
No. There's no giving up, no closing the doors, there's no... Like, Raquel and I have always said to each other, no matter what happens, if everything goes to shit tomorrow, we could do this by ourselves.
Yep.
And we would do this by ourselves. If it was just her and I and we had to run the machines, run the Facebook accounts, do the distribution, physically we could do it. So that's just the mentality we've always had.
We've never wanted to quit.
I'm curious on the agency front, obviously.
Yeah,
I know this, but I run a performance agency here, you know, global one with offices here in Australia and the US. Yeah. You know, core customers are e-com brands. So you name them, we work with them, right?
Yeah.
Normally, a lot of them are in fashion and apparel. So I know firsthand how important it is that agency relationship alongside the brand. Like, it's an extended team, right? What exactly happened there? I mean, were they specialized in e-commerce?
They had really good ads themselves.
Yeah, look, there's two parts.
They're very good marketers, right?
Yeah, there's two parts to it, right? There's the first part was not knowing if what they were doing was right or wrong, because I didn't know. None of us internally knew how to look into an ads manager account, a GA account, any of that. Google is still difficult to look into, but at least
the Facebook,
you know, Meta platform, the ads manager. If your only experience with it is what agencies tell you, then you just have to believe them, right? You just have to say, well, these guys are right.
Trust them, right?
Trust them. That's the whole point. So to be fair, even that agency that was, you know, the last agency that we had, my assumption was it was really bad, right? And once I fired them, I still didn't know if it was actually in the account really bad. I just knew that the money is not coming in for the money that's going out. And I'm just going to like make a decision here. So it wasn't until I learned it over a 4-week period that I could then go back and see the performance of the campaigns and the structure of the campaigns that they set up to be like, okay, I was right. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't good what they were doing. But I just have to use my intuition to be like, you guys are out and I'm going to figure it out. But I think what they did wrong was, you know, we didn't land technical, but we didn't land on the correct MER, to be fair.
Yeah.
So that was a mistake from the beginning from everyone. We didn't even know, we didn't even know what the term MER meant,
mm-hmm.
right? And we didn't even know that, you know, how to manage day-to-day profitability in a Facebook account. We didn't know any of that. They hadn't shown us any of that. So, you know, that was partly our fault as well. But, you know, once I'd learned it was different. And something that like was a massive red flag for us was that, you know, this ad spend, this $10,000 a month retainer for the account. And then once we hit $100,000 a month in spend, it was 10% of spend, which to me, even now, I know that that's like an extravagant amount. So their pricing was skewed to spending more. And it wasn't results driven and then spend more. It was just spend more. And their incentive was eventually get to this 10% of spend for their retainer. So it was just a bit of a mess. And look, again, as you said before, the mistakes made forced us into this place where we had to learn something from scratch ourselves. And I think that's the best, you know, thing that can happen to a brand is you're just forced to just take it on board and then actually have the understanding to drive the ship actually with your own hands and your own click the buttons and do the thing. It's so empowering to take that on as a brand and then to see huge results on the back of end of financial year campaign, day-to-day campaigns, and then like a Black Friday campaign that was just like out of this world.
That's amazing, huh? Like, I mean, there's so many brands that we speak to that wouldn't even know what MER means, right?
Yeah.
And frankly, to some degree, we probably don't expect them to, right?
Yeah.
But it's our job as the agency partner to educate them. Because we find that education is probably 80% of our role.
Yeah.
If we're not educating the brands around what we're doing and why we're doing and how we can take, you know, because, you know, a lot of brands, all they focus on is ROAS, right? They want ROAS.
Yeah.
Frankly, it's the biggest bullshit metric on the planet.
Yeah.
Right. So many, you can manipulate it. It doesn't make any sense. And so many times I talk brands out of measuring that as their core yeah. number. And it's not until we kind of take them down this education loop of like, what's your margin? Let's understand what we're actually playing with here, right? Like, let's work towards a CAC number or a marketing efficiency ratio. Like, there are other metrics to track, just ROAS. Yeah. ROAS is just a platform metric, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Every platform is trying to claim the conversion, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And a lot of the times we spend like 6-8 weeks trying to untangle the mindset of a lot of brands to go like, forget ROAS.
Yeah.
Like, it literally means nothing.
Nothing.
Right? Yeah. It's a metric for us internally as far as how we track the platforms, right? But, you know, what's your attribution modeling? Is there double firing of conversions across platforms? Like, there's so much that goes into this stuff, right? So, you know, and you mentioned, I think, before e-commerce equations. So Jay Wright, right? Like, he's a champion when it comes to Meta and that, right? Like, he's super good. And I know a lot of brands have kind of gone with him and he's taught them a lot. I think that's what you guys did was great that you actually did the education and then actually ran it yourself. Now you understand what goes on in there. And maybe, you know, eventually there might be a time that you do need to go out to agencies again if you go international into markets and so on, or
media
just blows out and, you know, you're spending $200,000-$400,000 a month, which
you know,
we've got brands that spend that sort of money cross border. It does become a little bit more technical, right?
Yeah, of course. You do need
some support around that. So I think, you know, that there's a huge learning in that is that you've actually learned what goes on in the platforms and you can not micromanage the agency, but get an understanding of what it is that they're doing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I agree with you. 10% at that sort of level is just ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. And frankly, like, and I'm very, very vocal about this, the way that the platforms are going, a lot of it is becoming automated.
Yeah.
You can't justify 10% of media anymore as an agency. You used to be able to, because there was an art and a science to what we did, right?
Yeah.
Like, optimization was truly a thing, right?
Yeah.
We're more and more now, these platforms are becoming automated and that's the direction that they're going into. So, you know, the agency's role then becomes very strategic.
Right? Yeah, that's right. And I think that obviously, you know, Advantage Plus, the creative is the driver in it, right? And And it really any, you know, any campaign at any level of the funnel, it's really the creative that's making the decisions. And
exactly.
It's just switching out, we've been talking lots about this, having like huge amounts of volume of creative so that we can put more money through these platforms, through multiple different campaigns. And when things burn out, just switching new content is really the responsibility of the brand. And then the agency or the person who's running the account just needs to be, again, as you said, the strategic thinker of where do we find new pockets of audiences to let the creative do the talking.
That's right.
So yeah, it's all about the creative.
Think about it, right? You're dealing with the consumer on the other end. They're just scrolling, right?
Yeah.
What is it that's going to actually stop them?
Yeah,
right? It's the creative. Right?
Yeah.
That's ultimately what it comes down to.
Yeah. And you know yourself that you see the same creative over and over from a brand, you start to get disattached to the brand because you're like, guys, like, send me something different.
Ad fatigue, right? Like, even I'm getting fatigued as a consumer going,
exactly.
Guys, come on, like, enough's enough. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Times you're gonna
you almost just like scroll faster past it. Yeah, like, get away from me.
Yeah. I've reported ads before. I mean, I'm probably the wrong person to be.
Yeah.
Like, if I see the same ad over and over again, especially from agencies, I'm like, skip ad, you know, skip the ad. Future aspirations. So, like, looking ahead, right? Let's go and look into the horizon here. You know, what's next for the brand? Where's the direction? I know you guys are launching 16 identities this year. So, in direction of the product, you know, what is it that you're super excited about sort of exploring or launching this year?
I'm very excited for our fragrances this year because I feel like they're just so grown up, like really, really beautiful fragrances, really elevated. The ingredients that we're using are like honestly top shelf. Really excited. I feel like we're like just about to crack the US market, which I've been trying to do since like year two. Mm. So really, really, really excited to do that. Excited to introduce like different product offerings. Like we're about to do candles. I want to explore like, I really want to do like a laundry detergent. I've been saying it for so long, so I'm just trying to find the
they
right
all suck, right? So I think if you can bring in a different twist
and it smells like our fragrance, so I think new products, the US, and our fragrances for the year, and our new warehouse to finally move into it properly.
How big is the US portion of the business?
Right now it's probably 10%.
Right, okay.
Previously it was like 1%. And
we used to lose money there.
Yeah. So we really
a lot of brands.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of really good organic, no advertising, like traffic and conversions over the last 3 to 4 months. We've only just started probably a month ago spending on Meta through the country, very small amounts to see what sticks. But Raquel is like very focused on US PR, US activations, US influencers, connections, gifting. You know, it's probably 50, 60% of her thought process through the day, I think.
Get it in the hands of Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
We're close to Kim. Her hairdresser.
Brand will just blow up, right? Like,
you would have smelt it. Her hairdresser wears it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. There you go.
Yeah.
I'll disclose this. It's not really a secret anymore, but my sister-in-law is Misha, the fashion label, right? So Michelle.
Oh, cool.
So, I remember the first time that Kim wore her dresses, Michelle, like the brand just blew up.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely blew up. And we were obviously running the performance channels for the time. I was like, what the fuck just happened? It literally it just skyrocketed the brand.
Yeah,
I pray for that every day.
Yeah,
I think
when you get in the hands of someone like that, they just blow it up, absolutely blow it up.
Yeah, I think what's hard for us is they could be wearing it out on the street, right? Because we've gifted everyone's got it, right? But if they get papped in the street, you can't see perfume on the skin,
sure,
right? So we really need that, like
that post,
that like get ready with me, that moment, which we got with Chris Appleton, Kim's hairdresser. He just loves it. He's posted a bunch for us, which has been great. So obviously, like, the Kardashians have seen his posts about and would have smelt it on him. Eventually it's going to circle back and they're going to be like, can we just get some of this? So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's cool.
We so just as a, and again, I'm sure you guys have done your sort of due diligence, but as I mentioned earlier, like we opened up an agency in Austin off the back of a lot of brands from Australia that wanted to get into the US. The biggest learning I could probably just kind of pass on is every state is very different, right? It's like being in a completely different country.
Yeah.
So how you market to consumer in New York is 180 degrees different to someone in LA.
Yeah.
Very different to Austin. Like it doesn't matter where you go. So the creative is different.
Yeah.
Messaging is different. Everything's different. So it's literally just think about it as a completely different country, right?
Yeah. Crazy, isn't it?
It's so crazy.
Like, I think we're just doing California at the moment, aren't we?
Yeah, I think we're trying to land on where the US consumer thinks we're from, right? So, like, obviously we're an Australian brand, but are we an Australian brand that's now in New York and we're based in New York, or are we based in California?
The Yankees love Australian brands, by the way.
Yeah.
They love Australian brands.
And, you know, are we going to be that Cali brand that's, you know, gone across the state? So we're sort of, you know, get early days with, you know, understanding metrics and where people are coming to the site from. And it's too soon to make any decisions. But, yeah, everybody's told us that every state is a new country. And, you know, just
a little bit of testing in each one, right? And just see how it resonates and what.
Yeah.
There's obviously a personal connection to the fragrances here, right? So maybe, Raquel, I'll start with you. Which one is your favorite and why?
Oh, it's always the one that I haven't released
yet. It's always the next one.
It's always the next one. Lucky I'm not like that with husbands. No, I mean, like, Nomad and Morning After. So there are Nomads have been our bestseller for 3 years. Morning After, I just love it. It's such a beautiful fragrance. And then the next one, honestly, all of them this year are just so good.
If I had to pick one,
six fragrances today, just because I can't pick a favorite.
if I had to pick one for my wife, for Jess, right?
Yeah.
Nomad.
Yeah.
For me, Rebel Rose. So Rebel Rose came out just before we went to Europe last year with Wall Street, and just after actually.
Yeah.
And we had it in Europe.
I looked at the samples.
The samples of it in Europe. So for me, as soon as I wear it, it just takes me back to
Europe.
To Europe.
Whereabouts in Europe?
Mykonos.
And Santorini.
Italy. Yeah. So loved it. So every time I wear it, it's supposed to be layered with Wall Street, but Wall Street is definitely the more like masculine partner in that combo. But for me, it takes me back to Mykonos. So I'm always on it.
I'll send you some perfumes today because you have to smell them. I should have done it before. I'm excited.
So in closing, guys, you know, advice for inspiring entrepreneurs, right? If I'm sure there's a lot of listeners at the moment that are starting out or they're in halfway through the journey or so on, like what advice would you give them?
No one really in life knows what they're doing. So if you feel like you don't know what you're doing, just keep doing it because you will learn it. Like I find that like I speak to people like in other businesses that are really high up and I'm trying to get an answer out of them. And they're like, I don't really actually know. And I'm like, how do you not know? So I think that stuff's always given me comfort that like not many people know what they're doing or how to do it. We're all just winging it day to day and trying to learn how to do it our own way. So I think learning how to do something your own way, listen to podcasts. I feel like that is honestly how, because I didn't really have Adam at the beginning because he had his own business and he was, you know, stressed in his own business. So I really leaned on podcasts. So I think that really helped me at the beginning to teach me how to build somewhat of a business. Having like mentors in your life, like I'm lucky I've got Adam, and just like meeting people along the way. And I think don't be like too shy to ask a question. Like I feel like there's some dumb questions, but like no question is a dumb question. I feel like
I think like you have to really like genuinely put in the work. You know, a lot of people talk about doing the thing, a lot of people read about doing the thing, they ask someone about doing the thing, they plan to do the thing. just do
they never do the thing.
They never do the thing. Just got to do it, you know. And I think that you intuitively know the things that you're doing that are holding you back from where you want to go. You just got to, so, you know, blinkers on, tunnel vision, just do the work. And surround yourself, I know it's so cliche, but like surround yourself with people that are going in the same direction. You know, I've got a lot of friends that stayed as tradies, and, you know, I love them. They're my boys, right? But I don't hang with them for business advice. I don't hang with them for what is your goals? How big are we going to go? What's happening next year? You know, you got to find these people and actually like build relationships with people that are trying to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's super important. And we got to a point where I didn't know the answers. Like, I'm very open about, like, I got us to this point where we were real business, we were scaling, I knew operations, I knew the basics of getting us to this point. The moment that I realized I'm in the way here, we need to get actual help here, we found some of the best business advisors that came onto the team, and they just like sigh of relief, like they knew the next steps for us. So don't be afraid if you don't know where to go to next. Like, you've got to go and find people that have been there. You'll find, if you found me on the, like, if someone came up to me on the street and said, I need help for you, I'll help you blindly without even knowing you or what. Like, we want to help people. Like, people that have done it, people that have significantly done something, they want to help people. It makes them feel good about their success, right? So just find these people, ask the question, work your fucking ass off, you know.
I love that, man. It's like, you know, I've always been a big believer in you're the average of the five people that hang around.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So if you just think about that in context, you know, if you hang around losers, excuse my French, but if you're hanging around people that are just not going anywhere in life, well, they're only going to drag you down. Right?
Yeah.
If you surround yourself with the right entrepreneurs, the right mentors, the right business owners, whoever they may be, right, they're only going to lift you up.
Yeah.
Because you just become a sponge. You absorb everything.
Yeah. And you feel like, you know, you're behind. Like, I know for me, I've sometimes gone into a meeting or gone into a dinner or an outing, and I'm like, I'm so out of my depth here. Like, I don't know what these guys are saying, but you leave and you're like, that's the place I need to be.
That's
like,
part of the growth, right?
Like, it's just challenging. Part of it. And yeah. You sort of, even when you go on to learn new things that are big things, that are scary things, and you go into these courses or whatever it is, it's like a new language.
Yeah.
But after 3 or 4 months, you then can start to talk it, and you then start to becoming completely understanding what's going on. It makes such a big difference. But, you know, I feel like there are moments where I need my best mates, my boys I go play golf with, and just like forget about all of it. That's important too.
You're a golfer. But
yeah, love golf. But yeah, I think finding these people, sticking close to them, learning off each other, work really hard. You know, it's all the cliche stuff, and it's really what works.
But that's what works, right? It doesn't need to be any more complicated than.
Yeah.
Raquel, Adam, guys, thank you. Super inspiring. I'd love to chat. Truly built something super incredible, and I look forward to seeing where you're going to take this brand.
Thank you.